Gibson Reel 12. What other memories have you got in working on this road?
Well, first of all, the food. The food was the worst of any camp I'd ever been in. And it had been bad in other camps. They relied on an elephant bringing our food up. And that elephant used to bring up two things. One was like green, which we thought might be cabbage, which had been dried out. And the other we thought might be potatoes sliced that had been dried out. With the result that when they came out of the sack, they had to be put in water and boiled up. We used to call the green stuff gas cape. I don't know whether you remember army gas capes. They were green and yellow, and that's what that was. So we were eating this gas cape and resuscitated probably potatoes with this rice. And the elephant one time used to come up with its baby, and this baby was a terror because it went for anybody, even the mahout was scared of it. So when it was approaching the camp, the Japanese would scoot into their huts, and from the huts point, and it was usually left to me to go to collect the stuff from the elephant, which meant running round the elephant, dodging underneath it, just to try to get away from this little one. Because the mahout wouldn't come down, he just wanted to hand the stuff round from the top. But the food was absolutely shocking. And we got to a state where I think I was about the only one able to stand up one day. There were 180 of us that had a count, 180 in the camp. Half of them were across the river in a hospital. The rest were lying around. And when the Japanese corporal came across, he looked around and found I was the only one standing up. He beckoned me across and he gave me the job of looking after the Japanese officer. I didn't know there was a Japanese officer, but he had his own little hut. And guess what? He was ill. I had to take him his breakfast. Luckily for me, he couldn't eat his breakfast. So that was the only change I had from this gas cape and rice. I ate his breakfast. Not that it was bacon and eggs or anything like that, but it was quite enjoyable.
What was it? What were they getting?
It was more like fruit, pineapples and things like that, you know. Not what we would expect for breakfast. And I'd have to take them water and then take them more meals. Next morning, breakfast again. Ah, malaria, no good. Malaria, no good. That's all he could say to me. So I ate his breakfast again. And then I realised that Pat Geldard, my friend, was in the hospital across the river. So the next breakfast came, I decided I would go across the river, swim across, one hand holding the breakfast, and shared it with Pat Geldard. And when I got back, he was feeling a bit better and he wanted his breakfast.
So how do you get over that problem?
I went back to their camp and I told them more tax and more, you see.
And your friend, what was he suffering from?
A terrible fever. It wasn't malaria and it wasn't dengue fever. Because when he was in the hut back with me, I used to get buckets of water and practically throw it over him. And to this day, I said, Pat, can you remember? I'll be meeting him this afternoon. He's 86 years old. He's been married 50, 67 odd years, I think. I'll meet him this afternoon. He said, I can't remember what was happening. He was so far gone. I used to throw tins of water over him until he got back into this hospital.
So that road must have been lined with the dead who'd worked on it.
No, just at that camp, we buried the men as they were dying. But a lot of them were sent back. We'll find out what happened to them later on. Because one time, there were only about half a dozen of us able to stand, and this same corporal, Japanese corporal, came over and he said, all men, war finish, England, Japan, shake hands, all men go home. Well, we could hardly believe it. We thought it was another one of their tales, you see. But I slipped through the jungle and had a look at their camp, and they were burning papers.
And had their attitude shown any signs of changing as this event was about to fall on them?
No, they said, all men go home. I went across the river to get Pat, and the man had just died, practically lying on top of him. I said, Pat, get to your feet, we're going home. And I had to sort of push Pat onto the road to start. The Japanese, two or three Japs that were in charge of us going down, they're still carrying their rifles and bayonets.
So they were marching you towards the...
They were marching us down country towards the sea, the coast. Rifles and bayonets, and they were using the rifle butts on Pat because he was slow. So did that give you any confidence in believing them that the war was finished? Well, we walked for another 2 days, and then we reached a camp, and the medical people took charge of Pat. Medical people came up to me and they said, is that a guitar you're carrying? Can you play? Yes. Will you come? These men have not heard any music or singing or whistling for months. So that was my first job. Although I was tired from walking, I had to go around and play and sing to the men in those camps. I said to the orderly, I'm not doing much good. He said, listen, he said, those three men that are sitting up, that's the first time they've sat up for days. And when I looked at these three men, two of them were from my own regiment.
And did you know them?
Yes,
from your own regiment?
I recognised them.
You remember the names again?
Sergeant Jack Robinson and Bombardier John Sugden.
And what state were they in?
Shocking. The hut they were in had no walls. It was just straight to the ground. And they were hardly able to sit up. When they sat up, it had to be in the middle because of the height of the thing. It was called Death Valley, that camp.
You know geographically where it was, where you'd been,
yes,
where you'd come to?
It was near Prachkrikan.
And that's Thailand, is it?
That's Thailand, yes. Coming down on the east coast towards Malaya.
And it seemed to have been just a reception. Were other people coming in to this camp?
Our camp from Tagare, where we had that 180 at one time, we were the only people to come down. We were the only people that had survived up there. All the rest had come down because they were sick.
So this was a sickness camp originally?
Camp, yes.
And was the whole 180 of you able to come down there from the other
camp?
Well,
by the time that was a count on 180, it was a week or two later, we were burying them about 12 every week, so I don't know how many would be left to come down.
And was it well known in the camp that the war had ended?
Yes.
And here were men dying, with that knowledge, but
yes,
knowing they weren't going to, still weren't going to survive.
Yes.
It's been a desperate, desperate situation.
I got down from that camp and I walked down and I had a sight of the sea. And to be out of the jungle and to be able to see the sea was a tonic in itself. And I went back to my hut and the man nearby died. I just thought he'd survived until then. They were free, and he died on that day.
And were the Japanese still with you? Were the soldiers with you?
Oh, the Japanese were still guarding things with rifles and bayonets. And it wasn't until a chap dropped from the sky that we realised what was happening. In fact, he dropped from the sky, and we all saw him in the distance. And in my hut, we had Australians and a few Americans, you see. And this magnificent looking fellow, of course, the Australians. And they'd been giving us a terrible time, you know. Churchill had made mistakes, Wavell had made mistakes, the British army was no good. This was the Americans and the Australians. So when they looked at this magnificent fellow in this strange uniform, we'd never seen a uniform like it. Oh, he's American. Oh, he's Australian. And when he shouted, "Now gather round, chaps," we realised he was British. But you see, we'd never seen red berries. We'd been away for more than 4 years. We didn't realise the uniform had changed so much. And he told us the war was finished. And he said he would give us a piece of paper, and there were about twice the size of that. Would we write our names on one side with a sentence or so, write the address we wanted to go to, and he would see that they were flown back to England. I've still got that piece of paper. We wrote it out, we borrowed pencils and wrote it out and gave it to him. And while he was standing there, some of our fellas came up, they were having their lunch, their rice and their gippo. And he looked in the mess tin, he says, "What's that?" "Oh," he said, "it's pretty good. We're having kitchen ajune today. Instead of just the rice and gippo, there were these small green peas called kitchen ajune." He said, "Do you mean to say that's what you're eating?" We said, "That's good compared with what we've been eating." So he shouted to the Japanese officer. And he said, "Get these men some better food." And we knew then that the war must be finished. Anyone who could speak to a Japanese officer like that.
He must have seen the dreadful condition that you were in, of course.
Well, he looked around, he'd seen us in our Jap happies and no shoes to our feet.
What rank was he?
Probably a captain.
And from the Paras or somebody, special force of the kind. And he was on his own? He dropped in there just on his own?
I think he'd come down with one or two fellows, yes.
Your own feelings at that moment, if you recall them, what were they?
Oh. It's hard to tell. Unbelievable, really. Couldn't believe that I'd got through it. I mean, when I joined up with the expectancy of maybe being killed or wounded. Didn't expect to be taken a prisoner in such conditions. And the fact that I'd got through so much dysentery, so many doses of malaria, typhus, beriberi, pellagra, all these things, and watched so many men around me die. Why had I been chosen to live? I just couldn't believe it.
Was there anything that now you could think might have helped you to get through in the way that you did? Or was it just, what do we say, what luck, fate, or whatever you want to call it?
I think you had to have determination. No matter how ill you were, you had to say, "I'm going to try to get better." You also had to have something to occupy your mind. You see, there's body and mind. And with me, I was wrapped up in music. Wherever I went, I would seek out someone who knew something about music or could do something with music. and I would learn from them. From not knowing how to tune up a guitar, not knowing anything about chords, I was playing in this orchestra, playing anything from opera to jazz, and writing. Incidentally, I wanted to write music, and so I learnt a Korean tune, and I played it to the Korean guard and asked him if I could have paper. If you were found with paper and pencil, they thought you were writing diaries and you were punished. So I was given this little book of paper, and the Japanese interpreter, instead of signing his name, they had little stamps. And he stuck a stamp on, which meant that I, of a very few people, were allowed to have paper and pencil and to write. I've still got that, and I've still got his stamp. So it was something you could be wrapped up in. Determination to survive and something to occupy your mind.
Did the various camp officers, British camp officers that you were with in your experiences, do you think they had a role in this to keep their men's spirits going, to keep them looking forward?
Oh yes, some of them had, yes.
So obviously some of them being pretty bad state, but...
Yes, you have good and bad in everything, and we had some good officers. But we got... on the Mergui Road, for instance, there were no officers. While we were at Nakompaton, they took the officers away. That ruined our orchestra, because nearly all our orchestra were officers.
This one chap dropped, as you described. At what point did the actual relief column, or whatever you want to call it, appeared? What happened to you then? What happened to you next?
Well, this officer said that a plane would be coming to take us to Rangoon. And he looked around, he said, but I don't think this plane will be able to land here. So what happens? We all start working again, clearing the brush and the trees, making a landing strip so that the plane could get down.
But that would be different work from what you'd be doing.
Oh, it was happier work, yes. And a Dakota came down. And I have a little diary. And I got the names, I've still got it, of all the men on that, the pilot, the co-pilot, the navigator, and they wrote down the date, what height we were flying, latitude, longitude. So I had a great time on the plane doing this with the crew. But unfortunately, before they took off with the plane, the pilot said, look, I don't know whether I'm going to have enough room to get off. I don't know about the weight. He said, so can you come on as lightly as possible? Well, I took him at his word, and you know the guitar that I'd made. Although it didn't weigh very much, I left it behind. Incidentally, by that time I was quite rich, because I'd found some silk, and I was selling it to the Thais, and I was putting all the money in my guitar. When you've got a japap, you've got no pockets. And as I was walking across towards the plane, there were some Thai lads, you know, interested bystanders. And as you said, here, present all. And I gave him my guitar full of money. When we got off the plane at Rangoon, the first notice I ever saw was, bring your foreign currency here and we will honour it. So I could have been fairly rich.
Do you remember the names of the crew, or some of the crew, off the top of your head?
Not off the top of my head. I've got all their names there. One was a Canadian.
And where did they fly you to?
Rangoon. And then in Rangoon, we saw English women for the first time, because the WVS had flown out with Lady Mountbatten. Some of our lads met Lady Mountbatten, I didn't. We went into this hut. There were tables laid out. Do you know, we'd never sat on a chair for 4 years. It was strange to sit on a chair. It was strange to pick up a knife and fork. I'd never had a knife and fork for a long time. And we dreamed about this food. And there it was in front of us, you know. And nearly everybody was sitting around crying instead of eating it.
And your stomachs wouldn't be able to take certain foods, would they?
We should have had a lecture about this. Because we started to eat anything that we could get our hands on. And we should have been warned to take things easy. Because we'd lived on this rice and chippo for 4 years.
Did you suffer from that?
Well, I've suffered with my stomach ever since. Still wake up every morning now, pains. I've got a special bed that lifts me up.
At Rangoon, when you got off the plane, again, you were in pitiful condition, and you still weren't clothed, were you? You were still in the clothes that
We were a bit better clothed than we were. If they'd seen us in our japapis, and they would have been scared of us. We were like wild men. Lady Mountbatten said we all smelled different to anybody else. I think it was the smell of the jungle was on us.
And how did you get that improvement in clothing before you got to Rangoon? Did the Dakota bring stuff in with it?
Yes. Not that particular Dakota, but I think that the captain who dropped, I think he brought blankets and, do you know, first thing they issued us with was mosquito nets. Well, we'd lived in the jungle for all those years. We were giving mosquitoes malaria. So what good was a mosquito net after all that time? And we had nowhere to hang it up to. And I hope I don't get into trouble, but what's the first thing you do with your mosquito net? You go up and you flog it for $30 so that you can buy something to eat.
Were you debriefed on landing, or after landing? Someone interview you?
No.
You weren't debriefed in that way?
No.
So had you been able to identify any particular Japanese during your prisoner of war that you kept a
record to
report?
That was something that happened. They did give us a piece of paper and asked us to write down the names of any Japanese that were associated with atrocities.
And were there any that you particularly remember? I think you mentioned one or two.
When I looked around, everybody had put their name down, so I said, well, he's already down, Jungle Jim and those people.
Some of you, even when you got off the plane in Rangoon, would be hospitalised, presumably.
Yeah, well, I was taken to a convent hospital in Rangoon, in the city. And there was a sister, and she came from Berwick, and there was a sister who was from Northern Ireland, and they were very efficient. And they gave us clean pyjamas and slippers. And they put us into beds with white sheets and white... Oh, we weren't used to that, you know, sleeping in the jungle anywhere. And injections. And there was a general came. Just forget his name. And he gave us a talk. And he told us that we were trying to get us better here, they would look after us, and then ships were coming as fast as they could into Rangoon, and we would be taken home as quickly and as efficiently as possible. He got a cheer.
What injections did they give you?
Yes, well, I don't know what they were for, but... At the door to this, when I walked about, at the door to this convent led out onto the main street, and there were some DLIs came along. And I said, DLIs, are you from Durham? Oh, yes, yes. And I found out that some of them knew a relative of mine who lived in Sunderland who was in the DLIs. And chatting to them, He said, "How many of our lads are in there?" I said, "I'm the only one." He said, "Oh, well, all you lads are up at Five Faroo." And I said, "Where's that?" And when he told me where it was, I said, "Oh, I think I'll go up and see them." Now, dressed in my pyjamas and my best slippers, I walked through the town, through Rangoon, because to me that was well dressed compared with what I'd been. And I walked to this camp where I met up with Johnny Glancy, who had escaped the cholera. Conlon and Carney, the two comedians who had been, when they saw me, they were surprised. They said, "We heard you died." So I spent a couple of nights with them and then walked back one very, very misty early morning until an Indian in a jeep came by and he asked me where I was going. I told him, and he gave me a lift. And when I arrived back at that hospital, those two sisters laid into me. "Where have you been? You've missed. Where's your pay book?" They'd give me a new pay book. And I stood there while they were injecting me and writing into my pay book. They were very good, those two.
They must have been moved by the plight of prisoners coming out to have seen them for the first time.
Well, I suppose so, yes. And I suppose when I told them what I'd been doing, they realised that when you hadn't seen your mates for such a long time, you wanted to be with them, to rejoice that the war was finished.